Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Dwali Saikow-Tao in for Chris Boyd. 6 months ago, dozens of earthquakes measuring between 3 and 3.6 magnitude hit North Texas. Today, we'll ask a scientist and an environmental reporter about possible links between injection wells and tremors. Professor Brian Stump is a seismologist at Southern Methodist University. He's part of a team of scientists currently collecting data from seismic instruments placed in the Reno-Azle region. He was also part of an SMU UT study that analyzed earthquakes near the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. Lisa Song is a Boston-based reporter at Inside Climate News. She reports on natural gas drilling and environmental health. One of her latest stories focused on the fracking boom and impacts on Texas residents. Last year, she was on the reporting team that won a Pulitzer Prize for the Dilbert Disaster Series. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you, Dwali.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Lisa. You are there in Boston, but we're actually going to start here with Professor Stump. Could you start us off by just giving us an overview of what has happened since November in terms of, the quakes essentially kind of died down? We haven't heard about, earthquakes in the 3 to 3.6 range.
Yeah, I believe the last felt report was late in January, about a magnitude 2.5. That doesn't mean, though, that the earthquakes haven't continued. In fact, there was a very small event on Saturday, probably on the order of magnitude zero. Magnitude is kind of a confusing thing, but maybe 1,000 times smaller than the felt event that occurred. We know this because we were able to deploy instruments after the beginning of the sequence in November with the help of the United States Geological Survey. We now operate 12 seismic stations, and that data is providing a capture of the earthquake sequence as it goes forward.
There was an update where SMU reported 300 or so earthquakes, and that data was a bit confusing. When they say that 300 more earthquakes have been reported recently, what does that mean?
Well, it goes back to this idea of magnitude. And for each level, the felt events are magnitude 3 or so. And when we go from magnitude 3s to 2s, to the low 2s, we probably don't feel. And each magnitude unit, there are maybe 10 times more events. So if we will go from 3 to 2, we may be talking about 20 events. And if we go from 2 to 1, we could be talking about several hundred events. And so those 300 events are those small events that weren't felt, but they're very valuable because they begin to image the fault and the where the earthquakes are occurring and help us understand the process.
Now, talk about this study that SMU is currently doing, especially in comparison to the ones that you've participated in Cleburne or in the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport.
Well, in all three cases, in the case of the DFW earthquakes, in the case of the Cleburne, and then in the Azle Reno earthquakes, the first events were felt by local people. And there were no close-in instruments, and it's the responsibility of the United States Geological Survey in the United States for locating events. And those events have errors associated with them that are pretty large in terms of their spatial estimate of actually where the earthquake occurred. And so it's a common thing that when an earthquake sequence occurs, then we deploy instruments closer to where we believe they're occurring so we can refine the locations and better understand the faults where the earthquakes are occurring.
Now, by understanding those faults, what do you do with that data? What does that, how does that play out?
Yeah, well, one thing is we'd like to know how the earthquakes happen as a function of time and where they occur on as a function of time. They'll begin to map out the length and width of this fault surface at depth that has slipped. That is helpful in terms of trying to understand how big the earthquakes might become, although that's something very difficult for us to do. And then in these cases where there may be some association with wastewater injectors, what is the spatial and temporal relationship to those earthquakes, to those wastewater injectors?
Lisa, you were part of an eight-month investigation looking into essentially the fracking boom in Texas. Can you talk a little bit about that report and the work that you did on this?
Sure. It was a series that we did at Inside Climate in collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity and the Weather Channel, and we published that in February. Our focus there was really to look at the Eagle Ford shale boom in South Texas. So we didn't really look at the Fort Worth Barnett area, and we really focused on the Eagle Ford shale, which is this 20,000 square mile region, mostly southwest of San Antonio. And just since 2008, there have been more than 8,000 oil and gas wells drilled there. And it's a very rural region with not many residents. And now when you drive down there, you can just see a huge number of wells and compressor stations and processing plants and other signs of the industry all over the place. And we decided to focus mostly on the impacts of air pollution and air emissions because they tend to get less attention than the question of water pollution. But air emissions are actually just as serious. And what we really found was the Texas state regulators don't really know what's in the air, and they don't really understand the extent of the problem down there because the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which is the state's environmental regulator, they only have 5 permanent air monitors in the entire Eagle Ford Shale, and none of them are close to the areas of heaviest drilling. And at the same time, you have nearly 300 complaints from local residents in the Eagle Ford over the past few years.
And talk to us about those complaints. What are people saying about the environment and the kind of concerns that they've had in those areas?
Well, the complaints that were about air were people saying, you know, I smell a sulfur odor, I smell a rotten egg odor. People complained about getting headaches and having respiratory problems, aggravated asthma, nosebleeds sometimes. And it's kind of hard to tell from the complaints exactly what chemicals they might be talking about, but we do know that the various processes involved in extracting and processing oil and natural gas, you are going to emit many, many different types of pollutants. And that includes hydrogen sulfide, which is a naturally occurring gas that can be deadly. It's very toxic and irritates respiratory problems. You have things like volatile organic compounds, such as benzene, that can cause even cancer over the long term. You have things like particulate matter and sulfur dioxide, which are all respiratory irritants.
Now, that is actually a huge concern of a lot of the Reno and Azle residents because their concern, of course, is what's in the air there, too. I think before we continue this discussion, though, I would like to say, Professor Stump, and maybe Lisa, you can share in this, when we talk about hydraulic fracturing and the definition of that versus disposal wells or injection wells, what are the differences? Because I don't think that people really know the definitions of that.
Well, I'll start. In the hydraulic fracturing process, subsurface where the oil and gas may be trapped, you want to increase the permeability so that those fluids can flow back and we can recover those fluids. And so water is injected, relatively small volumes of water is injected to break and fracture the rocks so that those materials can flow back. I would distinguish that from wastewater disposal that probably has the highest link, the possible link to induce earthquakes. Wastewater is recovered with the gas and oil separated and then disposed of in injector wells. In the case of the Barnett Shale, where there are thousands of producing wells, there are a few hundred injector wells where these larger volumes of fluids are disposed of over a long time period.
Lisa, the reporting that you were looking at, did the locals understand what was actually, being constructed around them, the activity that they were witnessing or smelling?
No. Oftentimes, they didn't really know what was happening. And this is what some of the local residents have complained about, that they feel like sometimes these are people who have leased their own land, leased the mineral rights on their land to these companies. Sometimes these are people who don't have drilling on their land, but their neighbors have drilling on that land. And a lot of them just want to know what's actually going on. You know, they might wake up one morning and see a drill rig not too far from their backyard, and suddenly it gets really loud and noisy for a few days. They have trouble sleeping at home, and no one has come to warn them beforehand, you know, to say, oh, you might expect some noise over the next few days. And once one well is drilled, there might be another well right next to it. So they're often confused, they're frustrated, and they want just some more information about what to expect and what can happen.
Now, Professor Stump, the data on this sometimes is not transparent. Do you know why that is the case with some of these energy companies and where they construct the wells? And
I guess the siting of the wells and the drilling of the wells is not my area of expertise. But I do know here in Texas that particularly for the wastewater wells, the companies do report to the Texas Railroad Commission on a yearly basis. And they report the volumes and the pressures at which they inject underground. That kind of information is very valuable in trying to address these issues of induced earthquakes. And in Texas, it's a yearly process. When you're in the midst of an earthquake sequence, more timely access to that kind of data would be very useful in terms of trying to understand what's going on.
And that's essentially the mystery, isn't it? You know, are these man-made earthquakes, or are these natural? And can you sort of help us understand where natural faults are?
Well, I think most of us are familiar with faults on big plate boundaries, like the San Andreas in California, where we have large earthquakes that repeat on hundreds of years kind of cycles, and then we have smaller events that are associated with those plate boundaries. But when we come across the continental United States and we come into the central part of the United States, we do have faults. We have old plate boundaries that no longer exist, but those faults are still there. And our understanding of the crust is that many of these old faults still have stresses on them. And they're very close to failure, but we just don't see failure because there's no mechanism in which to increase that stress from a plate boundary. In the case of induced earthquakes, it may be that when we inject fluids underground, that we disturb that stress boundary a little bit and then trigger these earthquakes.
Induced seismicity is the correct term, right?
I would think there's two words. There's induced seismicity and triggered seismicity. And I think in some sense both terms apply in that in the case of the Azle-Reno events, as we've begun to image, we can see these subsurface faults. So they're existing faults that have stress on them. But then they're triggered by these fluids that flow onto the fault surface.
Lisa, you had said in your reporting and reported that essentially that the Texas state legislature is really not aware of the kind of toxic air pollutants that are there. So what's next? What needs to be done?
I think one of the things we tried to be clear about in our reporting is right now a lot of the attention is on hydraulic fracturing, but that is just one small phase of developing oil and gas. And to really understand the air emissions, you have to look at the entire cycle from drilling through processing.
Lisa, I'm sorry, we're going to just take a quick break here. We're talking today with SMU seismologist Brian Stump and Lisa Song of Inside Climate News about what's behind the North Texas quakes. And next Wednesday, June 18th, I'll moderate a KERA State Impact Panel discussion at the Azle High School Auditorium about this. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Dwahli Saikau-Tau in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is SMU seismologist Brian Stump and Lisa Song of Inside Climate News. We're talking about what's behind the North Texas quakes. Before we continue, here's Alex Mills, president of the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers.
When we search for the answers to what is happening now, that the regulators, the lawmakers, the industry, the public all adhere to the strict scientific data that is trying to be gathered now to find the solutions. The state of Texas wants the revenue, wants the economic activity that is created by drilling and production of oil and gas. The industry understands that we've got to find the problem and then address the solutions. If it is oil and gas activity, the industry definitely wants it to fix it.
Now, Lisa, is that your sense that, from the folks that you've been speaking to and the energy producers, that they do want to fix what's, in the industry?
From the people in industry who talked to us, they all said they really wanted to fix any problems that were occurring. But one of the big problems we ran into was we had a lot of trouble getting representatives from industry to even talk to us. We contacted the TCEQ many times. We contacted many of the major players down in the Eagle Ford. And between myself and some of the other reporters, we went down to Texas about 8 times on reporting trips. So there were a lot of opportunities to hopefully meet with in person and talk to scientists and engineers and representatives from the companies, but that almost never happened. And in most cases, we just got some emailed statements from these companies that really didn't tell us very much about what was going on or how they wanted to solve the problems.
Now, Professor Stump, you were part of the team that looked into the Cleburne earthquake sequences. There were possible links to the industry. Is that the understanding?
Yeah, I think that we were having a conversation before we broke about earthquakes in the eastern United States. And there are natural earthquakes that occur in the eastern United States. But when they occur in time and space close to some of these operations, the questions always arise, is there a physical relationship to the operations, such as wastewater injection? And that's the question that I think all of us want to solve in trying to make those relationships. In both the DFW and the Cleburne case, I don't think we had enough data to understand that physical linkage. And just to give you maybe it's too much science, but a little idea is we'd like to understand that if we inject fluids underground, how they might move from one location to another, whether there's a fault at those locations, and then how those fluids might disrupt the stresses on those faults and allow these earthquakes to occur. If we can understand that physical relationship, then there's an opportunity to mitigate the effects. For instance, move the injectors far from the faults or change the way in which we dispose of the fluids. And I think it's that case that we hope we're going to be able to solve in the case of the Azle events. And I would follow up with what Lisa said. This is a place where I do think industry wants to be collaborative in trying to solve these problems. Now, we'll see as we move forward, but it's a risk reduction for them themselves as well.
Lisa, what kinds of questions would you ask the industry folks, the oil and gas experts, the energy producers? What were you trying to find out?
Well, one of the things we wanted to look at was sometimes when you have a gas processing plant, for example, there occurs what are called emission events or upset events, where suddenly something goes wrong at the plant and there is a huge, sudden, unexpected burst of air emissions. So within within the span of a few hours, they could emit more toxins of a certain type than they normally are allowed to emit in a month or even a year. And these events are not supposed to happen. But, for example, we found one processing plant in the Eagle Ford that had one of these emission events every other day for a year. So obviously there is something systemically wrong that was happening there. And when we went to the company just said, well, they didn't give us very many details and said they care about the environment and they're trying to fix things. But we would like to know in more detail how exactly they're trying to fix it, what theories they might have, especially because it's happening every other day over a year, and these things are maybe only supposed to happen once or twice a year as a genuine accident.
Professor Stump, the data that was looked at with the Cleburne sequences, was that given to energy producers, energy makers, to see if that might, inspire them or cause some kind of change?
Well, in the case of the DFW earthquakes, in the case of Cleburne, and in Azle, we've deployed instruments that have been made available from the National Science Foundation, from the USGS, and there's an organization called IRIS, which is a consortium of universities that do seismic programs. And so we've put the data at their data storage facility and made it available to everyone. So it's openly available with the idea that all people can come and use that data to try to understand these processes.
And the data that's being collected now out of Azle and Reno, is there enough data there that can actually trigger some change in the industry?
Well, just from a seismic perspective, at both the airport and in Cleburne, we deployed 5 instruments, and that was all we could obtain. In this case, we have 12 instruments. They're delivering data in real time. And I think that you can just see already from the seismic perspective, we're locating hundreds of events and beginning to image the faults. So I think it provides the data set that in collaboration with people that understand the subsurface properties, where the faults are in subsurface, how the fluids flow, that we might really have an excellent chance this time of trying to make this physical understanding of the processes.
We have a caller from Dallas. Mark is with us. Mark, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Now, the cause of a major earthquake is two plates on a fault line moving in opposite directions, hanging up on each other and building pressure over many, many years, and then finally releasing that pressure and causing the major earthquake over, say, 50 or 100 years. Now, if these plates along the fault line, if they are triggered every couple years by something, whatever, and that fault line never builds up massive pressure to cause the earthquake, wouldn't these smaller earthquakes be beneficial in preventing a larger earthquake over a 100-year span?
Mark, that's an excellent question. It relates back to this idea of the size of earthquakes. If we look at an earthquake like that occurred in 2011 in Japan, magnitude 9, and every magnitude unit from a 9 to an 8 is a 30 times in energy. And so if you were to trigger 30 magnitude 8s, you would get to a magnitude 9. And if you go from 9 to 8 to 7, it would be 30 times 30, so it would be 1,000. And so if you were going to trigger small earthquakes that didn't cause any damage, you would be triggering hundreds or millions of these small earthquakes. And so it's not very feasible to do that. And the other question is, if you were to trigger a small earthquake, how do we know that we might not trigger the larger event?
And that's
right, but if the pressure never builds up enough, the larger earthquake can't happen at that point where it is triggered.
Yeah, if you look at, let's say, the San Andreas in California, 1857 in the southern part of the San Andreas, the stresses have been building for 150 years. I just don't think we as seismologists understand enough to go into a fault system like that that has that much energy and then try to engineer events.
Great. Thanks for your answer.
Thank you, Mark, for your call. Lisa, I want to bring you back into this conversation to talk about air pollution and how this works in, especially in places that we are not familiar with and places that are rural, places that where you've been reporting from in the Eagle Ford Shale.
Well, one of the things we discovered about the Eagle Ford is that it's actually regulated a bit differently from how oil and gas is regulated in the Barnett. So in the Dallas-Fort Worth region, because of some steps taken by the Texas state legislature, that area actually has more stringent air regulations when it comes to oil and gas than the Eagle Ford. So there are a few counties in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that have certain additional restrictions when it comes to air emissions from this industry, but those regulations only apply there and not to the rest of the state. So that means the Eagle Ford residents don't get that additional benefit. And that was one interesting aspect that really speaks to a kind of environmental justice issue, because generally the Eagle Ford region is more rural, they have higher levels of poverty, and they have less people, but also in general lower levels of higher education than the residents of the of the Barnett area.
So at this point, a lot of those residents, are they moving out? Are they having to live with this? What are people telling you?
Well, we haven't been able to do a systematic poll of everyone in the Eagle Ford or anything like that. But one of the families we followed in our original reporting from February told us recently that she and her husband are going to leave. They've started house hunting, and basically the pollution and her deteriorating health have driven them away from their home where they've lived for about 20 years. And there's a second resident I spoke to who there's drilling of several wells outside her house. There was a lot of drilling near her home last summer, and the noise was so loud that the companies actually paid for her and her neighbor to move into a hotel for 3 months. And this summer, she's having to repeat that process.
Now, in the Azle-Reno region, we're trying to understand what actually, what the activity is, what the injection, where the injection wells are, where the disposal wells are, and what actually is there. Some of the industry people tell us that, yes, oil and gas is going to get more, come into urban areas more and more. It's just inevitable. So how do we help people understand how to live with this, Professor Stump?
Well, in terms of the earthquake hazards, I think part of it is understanding what an earthquake is and how it releases energy and where it occurs. I do think, though, that we do, and I'll go back again to making this linkage between, if there is, and the linkage between the disposal of fluids and possible subsurface faults. And if we can make that linkage then, and we can understand that relationship, then as we come into urban areas, maybe we'll change the practices and think differently about where we might locate injectors. We know, for instance, there are, 100,000 injectors, Class II injectors across the United States, and a very small number of those, that tens that might have earthquakes associated with them. So another part of this process is understanding those cases where we don't have the impact and why we don't have the impact.
The USGS had a recent report out about Oklahoma that they've had an increase of small earthquakes, essentially forecasting that there is a bigger one. Although all seismologists say they cannot forecast a big quake, this is still suggesting that that activity is linked.
I think when we look at earthquake sequences and the size and distribution of numbers of earthquakes, we use that as an estimate to look forward to the future, to, in a probabilistic way, talk about what is the possibility of a larger event. And so in the case of Oklahoma, where we see increased seismicity, we saw magnitude 5.7 in November of 2011, that alerts us to thinking about the hazard and maybe in increasing the alert that goes with that process.
And that's, in fact, what the USGS said. They were alarming people to the fact that this could be a hazard, and they need to prepare for something that could be.
Yeah, in fact, they have an article in June 2013 in Science that talks about earthquakes in the entire eastern part of the United States, the whole eastern U.S., where there's maybe 100 to 200-fold increase in earthquakes above magnitude 3 starting in about 2003 and accelerating over that time period.
With us on the line is Rita from Dallas. Rita, you have a question.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Professor Stump, you know, you mentioned that there haven't been any earthquakes since January of any consequence. Do you or do you not know whether these companies have just stopped deep injecting materials in the ground, which would maybe negate any earthquakes from happening?
Rita, that's a great question. The Texas Railroad Commission requires reporting on a yearly basis, and I believe that's usually in the October timeframe. And so at this point in time, we're, you know, many months past October timeframe, and so that data hasn't been reported, but we're hopeful it will be in a more timely manner. And that's exactly the kind of information that could be very helpful, in particularly in studying an ongoing sequence of events.
And Rita, I myself have gone out to Reno and Azle and to Springfield, Springtown up there, and have spoken to some residents who say that they have seen the activity decrease since January. And part of the concern is, well, maybe there was a lot of media attention, and now as media attention has decreased, oil and gas activity is increasing. And maybe there's a second round. So that's the concern that some people have.
I have actually heard that these companies aren't even required to report what they inject till November at the end of the year. Is that the case?
We'll be right back, Rita, after this.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Dwahali Saikautau in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is SMU seismologist Brian Stump and Lisa Song of Inside Climate News, talking about what's behind the North Texas quakes. But first, some voices of locals in Reno and Azle alarmed by the earthquakes.
I just built a $200,000 home out here, and it's being shaken. I just called 2 weeks ago when we put earthquake insurance on our house. That was an extra $100 a year that you shouldn't need in Texas.
We're sitting there at 11:40, and it rumbled right on through the house.
It sounds like a truck hits the backside of the house, the whole house just shakes.
Literally, I am waiting for the cedar beam that goes across my den to hit the floor.
That was Michael Loggins, Tom Converse, Tracy Strickland, and Barbara Brown, residents of Reno and Azle, who are concerned about a second round of earthquakes, especially because some of them say that the oil and gas activity has actually decreased since media attention has been so focused on Azle and Reno. Now, Rita, again, what was your question? Repeat your question for us.
In other words, as far as gathering the information on what's being injected and when they inject it and how often, isn't it true that these companies don't have to report that till the end of the year for the ongoing, you know, in other words, 2014 isn't reported till October or November of 2014?
Lisa, do you know the answer to that? I'm not familiar with some of the deadlines for the registration of this.
Oh, I'm afraid I don't. That would be a question for the Railroad Commission, who should keep that kind of data.
Right, right. Now, the Railroad Commission met last month, and there are concerns about, you know, possible changes and what is next for the oil and gas industry. We have another caller from Mesquite. Patrick, Patrick is with us. Patrick, you have a question? Patrick is Patrick from Mesquite. Let's go to Brett from Louisville. Brett, you've got a question?
Earthquake.
I'm sorry, Brett.
Are you there?
Yes.
My question is, in regards to these earthquakes, is it possible that they could actually compromise the casings of these wells and, you know, add to gas migration and potentially pumping out some of these fluids into the groundwater? I've seen the devastation an earthquake can cause even a small one, and you know those casings aren't that big. So I'd like your opinion on that.
Brett, I would say I'm not a structural engineer. This is an area where somebody like myself, who understands earthquakes and how they generate waves, then interacts with people who design, as you say, the wells and things like that. It also applies to the people that live in Azle that are concerned about their homes. The earthquakes that have occurred up until this time have been moderate in size, and my inclination is that they wouldn't have a large effect. But, you know, I'm not an expert in that area, and if earthquakes were to grow in size, then that certainly would be of concern.
Thank you. Lisa, you were in Karnes County. You visited with Lynn and Shelby. Is it Buring?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you learned from them and what their concerns are about, you know, what their home of 23 years?
Sure. Well, Lynn and Shelby Buring have lived in Karnes County for a long time. And when the boom started between 2008 and today, at least 57 oil and gas wells have been drilled within 2.5 miles of their home. We also found at least 9 different production and processing plants within that same area. So they're surrounded by a lot of industrial activity. And ever since it started, Lynn Buring has had a lot of very mysterious and serious health problems. Her asthma has gotten worse. She has had debilitating headaches. She has sometimes trouble with her balance. Sometimes she smells really foul odors. Occasionally, she even says she feels this oil sticky film on her skin when she goes outside at night and feels that the air and the fog itself is just really heavy and thick. So she's had a lot of trouble trying to find the exact cause of her symptoms, but we do know that many of the symptoms are consistent with the types of chemicals that are being emitted from facilities like these. The real question is, how much is actually being emitted, and are they emitted in enough quantities to actually impact her where she's living? And we really don't know, because there's not a single permanent air monitor in the entire county, even though Karnes County is really in the epicenter of the drilling.
Some of what you're describing, a lot of the Azle and Reno residents, in fact, some of them have been trying to understand if their health problems are, in fact, linked to the air around them and the water in their wells. And so those are similar questions that people have in Azle and Reno.
Yeah, I think it's a question that you come across no matter where you go in the country, wherever there's oil and gas drilling. And one of the big problems is we simply don't have the scientific data to answer anything for certain. The problem is we don't really know what exactly is coming out of each part of the process. We're not sure what concentrations the chemicals are. We don't know what concentrations people are being exposed to. And we really don't know how it's impacting public health. So there are so many unknowns and simply not enough data or studies or funds being sent to address these questions. And that just leaves a lot of confusion and frustration.
Professor Stump, the study that you, that SMU is working on in terms of collecting the data from Azle and Reno, will that be able to actually help definitively explain, you know, what, why these quakes are occurring and, you know, how long will this take?
I think over the last 6 months, we've measured the earthquakes, we've located the events, we understand where the earthquakes are occurring, their characteristics. I think in the coming months, we need to make the linkage with, if there is a linkage, with the fluids. And so that comes from understanding the subsurface material properties, how the permeabilities, what the flow processes, working with petroleum engineers as well as other geologists and geophysicists to build models to explain the data that we've collected up until this time.
Meredith is from Reno. Meredith, you have a question.
Yes, I do. You had a caller that was making a comment about, wouldn't it be better to have smaller quakes and thus have less damage? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Our problem is our farm sits at the epicenter of the majority of these quakes, and we have sustained multiple damage from this thing. We've had different medias out there, you know, telling us flat out, this is the worst damage they've seen in the whole area. We've got buckling walls. We've even got cracked toilets. We have animals that are injured from this, from running into barbed wire fences trying to get away from it. When are we going to get assistance from the Railroad Commission or the gas well industries who claim they're trying to do something about all of this? When will we get assistance to fix the problem that they have created?
Professor Stump, is there a likely answer in that?
Well, I would sympathize in that over my career, I guess the largest earthquake I've been in is magnitude 5.5, and even down to, you know, low twos, I've always been startled by the events, and the physical impact on people is significant. I cannot comment on you know, response to individuals in this area, but I will say that I think we're committed to trying to understand these events and mitigate their effects. But in terms of the impact on individuals, it's difficult.
Lisa, do you have some thoughts about that, especially with the data that you've gathered over the 8 months and looking at what the Texas state legislature is, you know, is not aware of, essentially?
Well, one of the things we found out about the legislature is the extent to which they are tied to the oil and gas industry. Something like about 1 in 4 state legislatures or their spouses have some kind of direct benefit from a company currently active in the Eagle Ford Shale. So there are definitely questions there. And one of the major issues that's come up is people, there are scientists out there who want to do studies, and sometimes small studies are done or being done to better understand the air pollution issue. But these studies take time, and science is a slow process. And as you are analyzing the data and trying to do the studies, years may pass. And in that process, the people nearby continue to be exposed to these air emissions and pollutants. So the question becomes, how do you try to protect people even as you're trying to find definitive answers? And I haven't really seen a good solution to that yet.
Meredith, I hope that helps a little bit.
Well, back when I was in college, back in 2010, I was doing studies on this, and I didn't get answers, Denny.
Well, we
never receive answers.
Well, we do understand that the Railroad Commission is trying to look into this. They have hired a seismologist of their own to try to work and collaborate with, you know, with locals and state officials. And really, I understand SMU is part of this as well, and with the USGS.
Yeah, I mean, we've been fortunate enough to be able to collaborate with USGS, and actually had great collaboration from people in the Azle Reno area as we've deployed instruments. As Lisa said, this takes a long time. I know it's been 6 months. It's taken us that long to begin to record enough events that we begin to image these faults in the subsurface. The next step is making and trying to understand if there's a linkage to these injectors in developing these subsurface models.
What should people do in the meantime then? As Lisa was saying, you know, people are being affected by the activity around their homes and in their at schools and other places.
I mean, one of my colleagues, she always says, I don't think we can no longer assume that we won't feel or be impacted by earthquakes in Texas. And so I think that means some education in terms of understanding the effects of earthquakes, even moderate-sized earthquakes, looking at our homes for safety in terms of thinking about articles that might fall off of shelves and things like that. Many of us live in brick buildings, and those facades, as some of the people in Azle have mentioned, have cracked. And making sure that if there was a larger earthquake, don't walk outside during the time that the earthquake is occurring, because even a single brick could be very damaging to you or I if it hit us.
Lisa, I'd like to give you the last word on this. Your final thoughts on this discussion, and where do we go from here?
I think one of the things we really learned in the Eagle Ford is the importance of planning ahead. So it would have really helped the residents in the Eagle Ford if, before the activity really moved into the region, if the state had started to gather some baseline data to say, this is what the air quality was like before the drilling moved in. That way you could compare it to what the air quality is once the drilling has begun. And this kind of forward thinking and planning is something that would help a lot of communities if drilling is starting to come into those areas.
Our guests today, SMU seismologist Brian Stump and Lisa Song of Climate News. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next Wednesday, join me when I continue this discussion at KERA State Impact Panel Discussion at the Azle High School Auditorium. Details are at kera.org. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. And you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Dwahli Saikautau. Thanks for listening and have a great day.